Hello and welcome to Philosophy Casting Call, the podcast that features underrepresented philosophical talent. I'm Elena Gauthier-Mamoril, your host and producer. Today, I'm excited to share my interview with Kristen Waters, the author of Mariah W. Stewart and the Roots of Black Political Thought, which is part biography and part philosophical analysis of Stewart's political writings and activism within the African-American community in Boston in the 19th century. If this sounds new to you, you're not alone. I was completely unaware of who Mariah Stewart was or what Black radical liberalism meant before I read this book. But now I can't unknow it. I even used what I learned to inform the Race in Politics and Stars Hollow episode on my Gilmore Girls podcast, Women of Questionable Morals, so check that out if Gilmore Girls is your jam. But as for the rest of you, remember the primer we got on non-ideal theory and Charles Mills in the last episode with Matthew Cull? Well, that will come in handy to understand what Kristen is talking about here, so strap in. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Kristen Waters. Hello, Kristen. Welcome.
Good morning, Elena.
Thank you so much for agreeing to meet with me. Would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Sure. My name is Kristen Waters, and I'm a scholar at the Brandeis University Women's Studies Center and a professor of philosophy emerita at Worcester State University and lots of other things beside.
And author of a book who was just nominated for the Pauli Murray Prize.
I'm so thrilled about that. I just learned last week about this nomination. And of course, a Pauli Murray Prize, what could be better than a prize named in honor of another almost forgotten woman who was so central to the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s and got kind of written out of history like Mariah Stewart. And from the African American Intellectual History Society, which is a great group. If you don't know it, I would encourage people to look it up. And they have a wonderful blog called Black Perspectives.
Did you encounter a lot of Black feminist thought in your philosophy degree? How did you get interested in that?
You know, in 10 years of undergraduate and graduate education, I did not read work by one woman or person of color. Think about that. We did not read anything by any woman or person of color in all that period of time. But when I got my first job, it was right at the beginning of the women's studies movement. And I think we cannot underestimate how that movement absolutely changed, transformed the academy. We're still in the backlash against that. And it was simultaneously the Black Studies movement. I'm reading a great book right now called The History of the Black the History of Black Studies by Abdul Al-Kalamat. And I went to a session at a conference talking about how important those movements were in sort of transforming what counts as knowledge. So very much a part of that project.
So when you decided to write this book 8 years ago, why Mariah Stewart? I had personally never heard of her, and I was just curious why her political thought in particular.
Well, most people have not heard of her. I'm hoping to change that. I was reading Patricia Hill Collins' Black Feminist Thought, which, you know, it was written in the 1990s, still a book that should be absolutely essential reading for anyone in any discipline or not even in the academy. It's such a profound book. And at the same time, I encountered a little book by Marilyn Richardson called Mariah W. Stewart, The First Black Feminist Theorist, First Black Woman Writer. And I thought at the time, why didn't I know? How come I didn't know about this? Collins, in her book, and, you know, I was kind of struggling with what to do in my efforts toward transforming the curriculum. And Collins has a passage where she says, you know, a lot of white women say, oh, I can't do this work. It needs to be done by Black women, et cetera, et cetera. And she says, no, that's not all right. There's too much work to be done. Everybody needs to do it. And at the time, there were probably maybe six or seven Black women who had PhDs in philosophy in the entire country, in the whole of the United States. One of them, of course, was Angela Y. Davis. Most of the other women weren't even working on race and gender. They were doing metaphysics and epistemology and logic and, you know, and so what are they supposed to drop their fields of interest in order to do this work? No. So I felt, I took that to heart and I felt it was incumbent on me to do that work. So I was teaching political theory at the time. And of course, you know, it was all the usual suspects, Hobbes, Locke, Marx, Rousseau, you know, Mill, et cetera. And I felt like I could not, in good conscience, teach that course that way. So, you know, back in the day, we would make these course packs. It's probably a violation of copyright. But anyway, that's what we did. People will remember. And I started including people like Mary Estelle, who was a contemporary critic of John Locke, Mary Wollstonecraft, of course, who was a critic both of Edmund Burke and Rousseau, people like Mercy Otis Warren, who was a critic of James Madison, and Mariah Stewart. And I paired Mariah Stewart with John Stuart Mill, her Stewart's essay on African rights and liberty. And I thought it was such a sweet pairing with Mill's on liberty, because there's Mill. I mean, Mill's on liberty is still the sort of, you know, Bible of the libertarians. I don't quite know why, but that seems to be the case. And he was, you know, a colonial factotum oppressing people on the South Asian continent, all the while talking about on liberty. And there's Mariah Stewart talking about real liberty for African Americans, including worldwide, Black people worldwide. So that was a nice pairing. I also included Frederick Douglass and Anna Julia Cooper. And then I went on to write another book. I don't know if you want to hear about that.
No, of course. Yeah, go ahead.
So a friend of mine at Holy Cross, a colleague of mine, was doing the same kind of work, Carol Conaway. And we conceived the idea of putting together a book that we called Black Women's Intellectual Traditions, Speaking Their Minds. Our notion was, you know, as we're finding all these women in the 19th century who were doing great stuff, including Cooper, including Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, including Pauline Hopkins. And here's the thing, and this is true in philosophy especially. It doesn't matter what your original work looks like if there's not a body of secondary literature, right? You can have been brilliant, but if there's not a body of secondary literature, nobody cares.
Yep.
Right? Yeah, it's so true. You know, and I mean, you look at those citation studies, especially in philosophy, where, you know, one person, you know, gets 57% of all the citations, and one white male, I'm not going to name him, gets, you know, something like 57% of all the citations in the journals. We wanted to change that. So this book, Black Women's Intellectual Traditions, had five articles, five essays on Mariah Stewart, along with these other writers that I've mentioned. And the purpose was really to start creating or really contributing to a body of secondary literature on those 19th century Black women. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, people still look to that book. It was published in 2007, and it did win the Letitia Woods Brown Award from the African American Black Women's Historians. To some degree, I feel like that accomplished what we set out. But I couldn't get away from Mariah Stewart. She just kept kind of coming back. I would go to other projects and she kept coming back at me.
I mean, I will dare to say that I think this book will also serve that purpose. Having read it myself, I can attest to the fact that you've done the work, in the sense you've really dug into, you have many, many references. You credit a lot of people. It's not about you saying, I have discovered this. It's really an act of reparations in the sense of this was going on. It has been obscured or eliminated from our history of political thought. And let me just say what all of these moving parts were doing, because yes, it is following the life of Mariah Miller, Mariah W. Stewart, but you name so many actors that were going on and everyone she was interacting with and who was kind of in the zeitgeist culturally at that time. And so this is a book that does a lot of historical uncovering, if you will. And so I think it will be useful because so many people can read it for different reasons and go down different paths. And now you've kind of created the secondary literature that someone will be able to cite.
I hope so. I like citing as many people as possible. And I wanted to, you know, get the sense that she in Boston lived in a community that it was really a thriving Black community over quite a long period of time. You want me to say a few things about her background?
Yeah, you give a kind of brief bio of who Mariah Stewart is?
Sure. So she was born, Mariah Miller, in Greenwich, Connecticut in 1803 to a free Black woman named Lib. I found the birth record, who was formerly enslaved in Greenwich, Connecticut, and Caesar, who may still have been enslaved at the time. And Greenwich, there were a lot of slaveholders in Greenwich, Connecticut. It was a wealthy community then, as it is now, including the Bush family, mm-hmm. who had quite a few slaves. And in fact, the Bush ancestor was a notorious slaver and so despised that his own crew shot him and threw him overboard. And interestingly, his name is Thomas Walker. And the Bush family is so proud that they named their children George Herbert Walker Bush and George W. Bush, W. Walker, after this really despised slaver. So, so she was born in Greenwich, although she says she was born in Hartford. I soul searched a lot about this. She was orphaned and then put into domestic service with a clergyman in Hartford, Connecticut. And she says, I was born in Hartford, but I think there's no reason to think that she didn't have that knowledge of where she was born.
Yeah. And to some degree that is more or less irrelevant. It was still the same region. It was still the same kind of social cultural realities.
Sure. You know, that was what she knew anyway. So she was indentured for 10 years to the clergyman. It was fortunate in one way in that it was a very literate family, but she hated it. She hated the domestic work. And she writes a lot about how much she despised domestic work. So she finagled to get out of Hartford. And I speculate that the great African-American minister, Thomas Paul, Reverend Thomas Paul of the African Baptist Church in Boston may have helped her. And I have some, if you read the book, I have a kind of scenario about how that might have happened. So she went to Boston, married a very wealthy Black shipping magnate, right? James W. Stewart. And she also met David Walker, who wrote Walker's Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World, one of the most, people always use the word incendiary pamphlets. And was sort of welcomed into the community. But shortly after that, her husband died, Thomas Paul passed away, and David Walker also passed away. And she was left destitute and was cheated out of her inheritance from her very wealthy husband over a period of about 3 years. And it was at that moment that she went to William Lloyd Garrison and handed him some essays she'd written. And he said, all right, I'll publish them. 1831, she was still in her 20s. So that's how her work comes to us.
And you describe how she interacted with people who are advocating for insurrectionist ethics and how she was very interested in the liberal tenets of Locke and the like, who are about, freedom and equality and liberty for all people, and really think about what it would mean to give liberty to all, what she calls Americans of African descent, or these kind of things, or all Black people. And I was wondering if you could say a bit more about what insurrectionist ethics mean and how Mariah Stewart interacted with these theories of liberalism that, in effect, at that time and since then, have been used to disenfranchise Black people and women in general as well.
Yeah, this is really a thorny issue. The book covers a period really from about the 1770s to the 1830s. And that's important because, Black people in the United States heard all of that Revolutionary War rhetoric. In fact, the colonists were always saying, oh my God, we're being enslaved by the British, And I think, they were just like, are you kidding me? Right? You want to know what slavery is? Look around you. This is what you're doing. And of course, there was slavery throughout the colonies. And so early on, they started using this rhetoric. I'm talking about in the 1770s, someone like Prince Hall, for example, wrote a petition, and he was one of many asking the state to liberate him. They were asking for a reduction in police violence. Some things never change. And people were reading, they're reading the Declaration of Independence. They're talking about it. They're writing about it. It's in the newspaper. So they absorbed that language of liberalism and they used it because they saw how hypocritical it was. Fast forward to 2022. And, I think we are legitimately wondering whether what I call Black radical or revolutionary liberalism is really a tenable theory for us now. It may have been strategic for them back in the day. And yet, especially because liberalism has such horrible connotations, maybe we should just put it down.
I tend to struggle with that a lot myself as I work on feminist theories of relational autonomy. I've grown more and more dissatisfied with the liberal takes on that, just because I find them quite reductive, or I find that they're still engaging in the same debates about individual rights, about a very narrow way of constructing liberty, freedom, agency, etc. But at the same time, we've also seen what happens when people are denied rights and when we're not allowed to speak about that. So it is something that I think we have to deal with. But I did think it was interesting reading your book, this idea of Black radical liberalism. And is that a theory that should be resurrected? Because if someone had said, like, well, we've seen what communism in the USSR has done, therefore communism and all socialism is bad, I would kind of put the brakes on that and be like, well, that was one instantiation of that theory. So should I be looking at liberalism and, its child neoliberalism as something that I'm like, well, is there another way? Is it worth returning to the theory and saying, can we enact it in what, fan fiction would call alternate universe? Like, is there something left there?
Yes. Well, I mean, should it be revived? It has been revived, and it's been revived by the great Charles W. Mills, whose passing we all really mourn. We just miss Charles a lot. But, Charles has such an interesting trajectory because he started out as a Marxist and became a philosopher of radical liberalism. He used that term.
Could you explain what you understand by that?
I wish I could explain it as well as Charles would have. There's a book that came out in 2010 of his. Everybody's read The Racial Contract, right? If you haven't, well, don't admit it.
I have.
There's a book that I've been reading, a book of his that came out in 2010 called Radical Theory, Caribbean Reality. And it's a collection of essays and interviews, sort of some older pieces and some newer ones. And he writes, what's the advantage of working within the liberal tradition? To begin with, the obvious immense advantage is that with the defeat of the socialist project, I take this as not controversial, liberalism is now the globally hegemonic ideology. Well, I mean, I think that not everyone would take that as non-controversial.
I mean, it's not wrong, but one could argue then, we must fight this hegemonic force as opposed to join it.
Well, two things here. One, the original liberalism was revolutionary. It was the ideology that fueled the American Revolution and some other revolutions as well, including perhaps even, I would say, the Haitian Revolution, which is another, not sufficiently talked about and hugely important event in history. And for people like Mariah Stewart, that revolution was not that old. So they saw the revolutionary qualities of it. If you're talking about insurrectionist ethics, which is a term that derives from David Walker, but Leonard Harris, the philosopher Leonard Harris, is the one who's really made the most use of it, and others, Lee McBride, they're looking at the revolutionary character. I would agree with you, however, that we need to look at this very problematic idea of individualism, of capitalism, and even maybe ask the question, is it the case that rights, the language of rights, is the best way to, concept around which to formalize a political and moral theory? I'm personally very torn about these issues, but I'm excited about looking at them. I'm so excited that people are talking about this. This is a conversation we need to have.
Absolutely. And from what I understand, the term radical in this context is really about the idea of roots, about going back to the foundation of like, what were these principles of liberalism and which are principles of liberty? And we take them seriously. And, history and infrastructure and systems have not taken them seriously and have disenfranchised and oppressed people. But the principles, if you will, in the abstract, are good principles. Then for me, it's kind of discussing, can we ever consider principles only in the abstract? And also, what would Mariah Stewart have to say about the importance of property and the self as property in classical liberalism when she herself was an indentured servant?
Well, to go back to Mills, he makes it very clear over and over again. He's talking about non-ideal theory, right? He's not interested in creating, some pie in the sky philosophy. I think also because Mariah Stewart talks very much about sort of the concrete ways of instantiating her beliefs. And I think two primary features. One is education. That gets to this idea of epistemic violence that maybe we can talk about a little bit. And the other is excessive labor. And she sees that that combination of knowledge deprivation and excessive labor is a very effective set of tools to prevent people from becoming liberated. And so she says, we need to build schools. She says, let's go to the American Colonization Society. They want to ship us so-called back to Africa, even though most of us were never there in the first place, and say, hey, can you use that money to build some schools for us? Right? And she also notes that the excessive labor that she was subjected to and that African Americans are pretty much still subjected to today make it almost impossible to put your political philosophy into action.
Which is almost a Marxist idea.
It is very Marxist. It's very Marxist. Good point.
Well, I wanted to talk about that because when in your introduction to the book, you set out this idea that there has been an epistemicide. There has been this idea of consciously not continuing and perpetuating these intellectual histories from Black people and Black women like Mariah Stewart. So, can you talk a bit about your project of trying to redress this and what you hope will happen going forward?
One of the motivating forces behind our Black Women's Intellectual Traditions book is that, you find that if there's a widely and commonly recognized tradition, people can just use code words. And here I'm talking about in school committee meetings or in local politics, right? I mean, everybody's always saying, oh, you know, I have my constitutional rights, even though most of the time they say that, in fact, they might be misinformed. But to be able to say there's a tradition that's at least 250 years old of Black intellectual thought is really an important tool to have. You know, there's this mania over the founding fathers. It makes me just tear my hair out. You know, you could go into a bookstore and there are books about Adams and Hamilton and Washington and on and on and on. And you think, where's Prince Hall? Where's Thomas Paul? You know, where's Phyllis Wheatley? On and on. And so part of it is sort of creating that tradition. But also, this is a little tangential, it bugs me a little and has for a long time that those of us on the left want to be out on the streets protesting while the people on the right are infiltrating the school committees and the city councils, et cetera, right? So here we are in a situation now talking about epistemicide, epistemic violence, where more than 100 bills have been introduced in various state legislatures across the country to ban teaching about racism. They would ban my book, right? To ban teaching critical race theory, which I taught for 20 years in my philosophy of law classes, right? It's astonishing to me that this is where we are. I have to say, that seems rather contrary to liberal principles.
I mean, as someone who is not from the United States of America, from the outside, a lot of what's happening there seems very contrary to lots of liberalism. But yeah, I was going to ask you that exactly about the banning of critical race theory with more or less a lack of understanding of what critical race theory actually is. Right. But this idea that using infrastructure to perpetuate a certain idea of history, do you think that means that we need to try and get back into these institutions? Or do you think we need to create a non-traditional way of educating people by giving them access to resources or having kind of informal seminars and things?
Great question. You know, the classic formulation is reform or revolution.
Yep.
We need to do both.
Kant was right for this. The only time I will say this.
Yeah, we need to do both. I mean, we need to be on the school committees where the perpetuation of racism in our public schools is pretty terrifying. And people who are in power are just looking away. You know, we need to be in the streets. We need to be making people uncomfortable. And so I think we need to do both. And the fact is that by being in the streets, by protesting loudly, you actually make more space for the people who are the reformists to do their work. And so it's a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, so it's about really opening the possibilities to different kinds of activism, because not everyone will be suited for every kind. But as you said in the very beginning, you know, as a white woman yourself, you feel a responsibility to do some of the work so that it's not all on the shoulders of Black women and other Black people to have to survive and also represent their communities and also be accepted within the inner circles of power and also all of the other things.
We can use our privilege, you know, it's powerful. We should be using it if we have it.
Absolutely. And I wanted to ask, there's a lot in Mariah Stewart's writings that is explicitly religious. And there is a long history of Black thought, Black feminist thought in the United States of America that is linked to various religious traditions, primarily Christian and sometimes Islam. Do you see this as something that is useful when considering her thought today? Do you find that this is an obstacle? We've been talking about, you know, right-wing institutions banning this kind of discourse. But I also feel that in the left, there is a reticence for kind of anything that has to do with organized religion as well. So do you find this is an obstacle in bringing up her theories today or not?
I think, you know, insofar as religion can be liberating, we need to embrace it. Insofar as it's going to shut down forms of thought or racist. I mean, the Christian nationalism that we are confronting today in the U.S. is very, very, very scary, actually. But there are lots of ways of being religious. She was extremely religious, but, you know, if we look at her, it's Stuart's time. It was around what's called the Second Great Awakening. After those three deaths that I mentioned, her husband, Thomas Paul, David Walker, she had a born-again experience. And she believed that the judgment day was coming, as a lot of people did. And her vision of the judgment day is fascinating. Here you're talking about radical. Her vision, and she writes it out, is that what's going to happen is the heavens are going to open up and the earth is going to open up and all the white people are going to fall into hell for what they've done to black people. And she says, you know, you will want to hide under the rocks that are falling on you to save you from the wrath of the Lamb. And so she's encouraging black people to come into the religious fold because she's worried about them, right? And she's basically saying to white people, you know what? Judgment Day is coming soon and you don't have a chance. So, I mean, that's a very radical vision. But we can be religious or not. We can be tolerant. I don't see why not.
And what are you working on at the moment?
I have an article on insurrectionist ethics that it's taken the back burner for a while. And I'd like to, you know, this tradition of insurrectionist ethics that comes out of the work of Leonard Harris has been tied to the pragmatist tradition. And there is a lot of talk about whether or not it belongs there. What are the features of pragmatism that either coincide or fail to coincide? So I have a paper that addresses those issues. I think they're important ones.
And what are you reading at the moment that is giving you life?
So, you know, I am reading the Charles Mills Radical Theory and Caribbean Reality, but also Myesha Cherry's The Case for Rage. And, you know, and I want to say, because I don't think we've said too much about it, Mariah Stewart talks about gender in every single essay. She has a gendered critique in every one of her essays. And she really is, in that sense, the founding sister of Black feminist thought. So, you know, among the other things I'm reading, for example, Margaret McLaren's book on transnational feminism. That's really important work. We need to, you know, I think as philosophers, we tend to become very U.S. centered. I bet you'll agree with that. And sort of fearful of, you know, making cultural missteps if we go beyond our own borders. We can't do that. We need to look at this very important material on transnational feminism. But I am also reading Robin Kelly's Freedom Dreams. Great book that talks about Mariah Stewart is Stephen Wheelock's Barbaric Culture and Black Critique. Lee McBride, Ethics and Insurrection.
So you're like me, you read 15 books at once.
Yeah, for sure.
Great.
Is there another way to do it?
I mean, some people are reading monogamist and they stick to one, but no. Not possible.
And that doesn't say anything about the, you know, the trash I read for pleasure.
Oh, I mean, I always hesitate to call things trash because you read them for a reason. And sometimes that reason is self-care. And sometimes that reason is you can't always read things about feminism and race that are important, but sometimes make you very sad.
Yes, true.
Where can people find you and your work on the internet?
Ah, good question. If you do Kristen-Waters, that should get you. If you do that Google search, Kristen-Waters, or even Kristen B. Waters, even though I don't use that. And I really encourage you, it is Kristen-Waters.com, but I really encourage you to do that because I need some hits on my website. And also, if anybody wants to go on, you know, some of the evil mega bookstore sites and even just give me some stars or some reviews, it's really hard when you're writing these books to get noticed. And I think it's really important to notice each other. You know, there's the site Black Authors movement, I'm not a Black author, but I am an author about race and gender. Yeah.
And I do want to say that this book is very accessible. So
ooh,
if people think it's like, and honestly, philosophy books sometimes can be challenging because they use a lot of jargon and they address a specialist audience. But because so much of this book is biographical and you really bring us into the history and the place where all of these concepts were born and activism was being done, it is immensely readable, and you mercifully break them down into short chapters, which I love. So I really want to encourage, if you've never heard about this or you're interested, this is definitely a book that will not make you frustrated because you can't like understand the language. The language is very beautiful and it's very clear, and you really get a sense of who all of these people were. So yeah, I definitely would say that this book has a broad appeal for even non-philosophers as well.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I tried to do that. I really, and I say in the introduction, look, if you hit these, you know, sort of heavy philosophical sections, skip over them because the story goes on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to read it all.
That's it. You could read part of the book for the historical context, part of the book for an analysis of Stuart's writing, and or you could do all of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for meeting with me. And I wish you all the best and possibly winning that prize. And
thank you so much. It's such a privilege to be here on Philosophy Calling. Yeah, it's just great and great to meet you.
Thank you so much, Kristen, for your time and for writing a book that should be in every university and public library, in my opinion. In fact, I'm going to urge every listener to ask their library to purchase it because it deserves to be a staple in the history of political philosophy. I'll link the book in the show notes as well as Kristen's website if you want to learn more. If you want to support Philosophy Casting Call, the best way is to rate the podcast and to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Also, tell me if you use Philosophy Casting Call in your classrooms because I would love to know. If you're in a position to donate, you can also become a monthly supporter on ko-fi.com. You can follow the podcast at PhiloCCPod on Twitter and Instagram, and all the transcripts live at my website, elenagotzimamril.com. Until next time, bye!